of your own ambition. You are not the type of person we need as our next Fain. And who do we need? You! Wanderlei glanced between Amali and Volhoric. Where is the horn? It's here, isn't it? You planned to blow it. Being the great-granddaughter of Glyndora Fain, you believe yourself to be the rightful choice. Isn't that so? That's what this has been about from the beginning. You're stealing the Forest Throne for yourself. I was warned about you. Vidar said you are dangerous. He was right about that. But he also said you were smart, and on that score he was mistaken. You forgot one important thing. I may not be a Frey, but I'm still a Myrillith. With Sign dead, I'm the only remaining Myrillith in this city. The only one who isn't 3 days away at the Nidwalden River. Wanderlei sucked in a deep breath, and with it he drew power from the people around him, from the dormant trees outside, from the fires burning in the braziers. Extending his arms, he began smashing holes in the walls. He tore down the balcony, which shattered on the floor. The whole of the Arinthian shrieked and rocked. I'm done holding up tradition! With a grunt, he destroyed another of the great pillars holding up the dome, and the whole ceiling slipped dangerously. The old ways are gone, he shouted. I am Fain, if not by law, then by might. Everyone here will serve me or die. Now, where is the horn? Emali didn't answer, but her eyes were on Volhoric. With a sweep of Wanderlei's arm, the priest slid across the floor toward the prince. The old Frey cowered in a ball, his cloak and robes a chaos around him. Wanderlei had assumed he was huddling out of fear, but he now suspected that wasn't the case. The primary job of the conservator was to keep the horn safe and present it to the curator when called for. Emali would want things done properly for her coronation. Wanderlei pulled strings in a weave and manipulated Volhoric like a puppet, spreading his arms and lifting him up to reveal a strap over one shoulder and a bulge at his side deep in the folds of his robe. Wanderlei gestured for the priest to come closer, and Volhoric acted as if each wave of Wanderlei's fingers were a forward shove. Using the priest's own hands, Wanderlei forced him to strip off his clothes and reveal the horn at his side. Wanderlei had never seen it before. Always kept in secret by the Aquila, it was a relic that most Frey had never laid eyes on. But they'd heard it the moment the horn was blown. All Frey, everywhere, perceived its cry. Wanderlei had always imagined it to be a jewel-encrusted treasure. The thing at Volhoric's side looked just like an old ram's horn with decorative markings. Bring it to me, Wanderlei ordered. The priest no longer needed to be manipulated by the art. He walked forward and handed the horn to the prince. Then he and Amali stared at each other, their faces reflecting fear.
It won't work, Volhoric said. You're no longer Frey. The horn will only sound for a child of Feral, and you've cast yourself out.
His words were brave, but his tone was just hopeful, less declaration and more wish. My soul is gone. You are right about that. He smiled a wicked grin. But Grindel theorized that the only thing required to blow the horn is to possess a single drop of Frey blood. And I still have plenty of that running through my veins. Let's see who is right. You or Grindel? He lifted the horn to his lips and blew. Chapter 16. Uli Varmar. She did not go with us, but she suffered nonetheless. I do not think anyone will ever know just how much. The Book of Bryn.
Persephone's feet crushed the snow as she walked. The paths between the four quadrants of the dragon camp had been packed down with traffic, melted by the daytime sun, and refrozen at night such that sections were turned to ice. The heels of her boots managed to leave divots, creating footholds that kept her from falling.
I need to ask Habit to toss wood ash along the glossy parts, and get the other fire tenders to do the same. It'll look terrible, but could prevent a few broken bones, not the least of which might be my own.
Persephone made daily visits to each of the quads to hear grievances and learn what was needed. Not that she could do much about the growing concern over Lothian's dragons or the worsening weather, but sometimes it made folks feel better just to be heard. People could withstand hardships if they knew they weren't alone and felt their sacrifices were appreciated. Persephone had learned this as a chieftain's wife and honed her empathetic skills as a keening. Simply listening made a difference. Returning to the center of the camp after completing her rounds, she found Nephron waiting in her tent. In his hand was the bottle.
"Who?" she said, no longer needing to ask what the container held.
"Elisan," Nephron replied.
He said nothing more for so long that Persephone grew aware of the snap and crackle of the fire that, under Habit's single-minded care, eternally sent sparks into the dark sky. Eventually, Nephron tightened his lips and added, he had his arms torn off by giants and was mounted on a pole while still alive, turned into a Grenmorian battle flag. The image was explicit, the delivery blunt, but Persephone held steady, watching him with a firm jaw and steady hands at her sides.
Ordered him north, to the giants, to persuade Forgenrock to assist us.
I know, she said.
He didn't seem to hear.
I felt he was best for the job. He got along with everyone, and was blessed with insight and artful with words. I've never known a wiser Frey. He made the perfect ambassador. I was certain he could persuade them.
He looked up at her then. His eyes were dull, only casting back the flicker of the fire.
Didn't work.
He pulled the top off the bottle, making a deep, hollow sound. Persephone remembered the night they toasted the deaths of Tekjin and the others who'd gone to the swamp. Nephron had been cheerful, after a fashion, wearing a classic brave warrior's face. He joked, smiled, and made light, silly conversation. That, along with sharing a drink of Ereviti, was how Nephron mourned. This time, he was different. Nephron seemed angry, but also sad. And there was an uncharacteristic dash of confusion. She thought a bit and realized Nephron had often deferred to the recommendations of Elisan, and he sometimes sought out the older Frey's opinion.
He was like a father to you, is that right? She asked.
Nephron appeared to think the question over.
No, he finally said. Zephyron was like a father to me. Elisan was something better. He was.
Nephron paused with a finger up, his eyes chasing a thought. Then he shook his head.
There's no word for it. Not in Frey, nor Runic, or even in Durg. There just aren't words for some things. I think perhaps it's...
Nephron's head jerked sharply to one side. His mouth dropped open in surprise. Persephone turned to look but saw nothing unusual. He was staring northeast, toward the forest and the river, which was a bad sign. The Frey had better hearing and more acute eyesight. She looked above the tops of the tents.
Dragons. Is he hearing them?
Will I see them in a minute? Are we all about to die?
Persephone braced herself for the sound of leathery wings and the blast of fire. Nothing happened. In the silence, she moved back around her tent and peered up at the Dragon Hill. The Galarabran was still there.
If dragons are coming, surely it would know and get up. Even if the danger was just the approach of the Fane's army,
It should lift its head. It remained motionless, and minutes later, everything in the camp was the same as it had been. Nephron, what's wrong? She asked.
The horn, he said. Someone has blown it.
What do you mean?
Persephone heard running feet on snow. Turning, she saw Sikar, Air, and Annival running toward them. The one bringing up the rear was still in the process of pulling on his cloak.
It's the horn, Air said.
As a Frey resident of the Dragon Camp, Air stood out as doubly odd because she was neither male nor an Instaria. Air was an Ascendoir. Since she hadn't moved to Meridid like all the other non-combatant Frey of Alenrist, Persephone suspected that she shared a bed with someone. Annival was the obvious choice, but Persephone couldn't rule out anyone, including Nephron.
The Ulivamar has ended, Annival announced.
Just then, Porik and Plimarath joined them, coming from a different direction. Together, they appeared as two ends of the Frey spectrum. Porik was small, fastidious, and pretentious, while Plimarath was big, smiling, and relaxed.
Lothian is dead, Sikar stated.
All of them looked east, stunned.
Porik asked,
How do you think he died?
Someone killed him, Nephron said hotly.
His anger baffled Persephone. Not only was it unlike him to exhibit such emotion, but there appeared no reason for it. The mystery was solved with Nephron's next words.
Someone who isn't me!
Annival continued to stare out at the dark winter's night with a dismal expression.
I don't understand. Who would break Feral's law? And why replace Lothian now that he has the advantage? Is it possible he was eaten by one of his own dragons? Plimarath asked.
Persephone thought this might have been a joke, but no one laughed or smiled. She didn't either.
I don't understand what's going on. You all heard a horn?
I didn't hear anything.
You're not afraid, Annival told her.
The physician who had helped her after the Rao attack recognized what all the others appeared to miss, that she wasn't knowledgeable about the Frey laws of succession. What's more, he realized how rude it was to ignore her ignorance. Snapping closed the clasp on his cloak, he took a step closer.
It is Feral's pact.
We're all bound to the horn by birth. If you have Frey blood, you hear its sound when someone announces their challenge to be Fane.
Why do you assume Lothian is dead?
Couldn't someone be challenging him?
No.
Lothian has already been opposed. So the horn remains silent until his reign ends.
His son has first rights to the throne, so it's Moandoulay who is being confronted.
So someone is challenging Lothian's son? Persephone asked.
Not necessarily, Porik said. It's possible he's dead too.
Maybe, Annival nodded. But the horn would need to be blown again by this time tomorrow for that to be true.
It's possible whoever blew it might go unchallenged.
Porik spoke as if he was an expert.
Persephone had her doubts. Porik was the sort to always assume he was right.
Doesn't matter, Nephron replied, and finally drank from his bottle. It will be another Miralith.
Persephone didn't want to drink. She had questions and needed answers that no one gathered there could give her. With Lothian dead, perhaps the next ruler of the Frey would be willing to seek peace. Maybe a Miralith had been forced to murder a loved one, to make the dragon at Avampartha, and they killed Lothian in retribution. If that were so, there was a chance they could be reasoned with. Nephron and the others didn't know who was challenging to replace Lothian, but she knew someone who probably did. Persephone climbed Dragon Hill in the dark. She stood 20 feet from the sleeping beast and waited. After several minutes, when her feet had sunk into deep snow and grown cold, she suspected she might be an idiot.
I don't know what I was thinking. He's just a man.
He doesn't actually know the future.
If he really knew everything, he would have known I would have come here even before I started this way.
He should have been waiting. He should have been...
She heard the crunch of snow as a tall figure came toward her out of the night.
Good evening, Persephone, Malcolm said in greeting, vanquishing her doubts. He looked the same as always, tall, thin, and not all that special. That night he wore a heavy winter cloak.
Does he even need it? Is he affected by the cold?
They stared at each other for a moment.
Why doesn't he just tell me what I want to know?
Everything suddenly felt absolutely absurd. They were standing in the cold snow at the foot of a dragon-like beast, where she plans to ask Malcolm questions, the answers to which he couldn't possibly know. Except she knew he did.
What just happened? And don't feign ignorance. Lying won't help either of us.
He shrugged casually.
You already know. Lothian is dead.
How did he die?
Murdered by his son, Wanderley.
Oh.
Persephone was surprised Malcolm was forthcoming with information.
Will I be able to broker peace with the new leader of the Frey?
No, but that won't be necessary as long as you keep Nephron here.
Persephone's fingers were cold. She didn't have mittens, so she tucked her hands into her armpits.
You keep saying that as if this is going to be a problem. Is there going to be a time when Nephron wants to leave?
Yes.
My husband is many things, but flighty isn't one of them. He doesn't do anything without reasons, usually good ones. If he thinks we need to pull back, I suspect the retreat will be warranted.
I wouldn't make such a point of it if staying will be an obvious choice.
But you promise everything will work out?
He didn't answer immediately. The pause bothered her.
Nothing is absolutely certain.
What's that supposed to mean? If what you say is true, I'll likely be risking the lives of everyone I know on just your word. I might be risking the future of unborn generations as well.
I don't control the universe, Persephone. I can't guarantee success.
What are you talking about? Of course you can. You can see the future.
Not all of it,
he said casually, almost like a joke. Maybe to him it is. Persephone had already begun to question whether Malcolm was human. If he was something more, it could be that everything happening to her people was nothing more than entertainment.
She struggled to reconcile the Malcolm she'd first met with this one.
They seemed so different. Or perhaps she just hadn't been paying attention.
He was the one who struck Arion on the head with the rock. Everyone else had been terrified. Even the Frey were helpless against her. But Malcolm got away with an assault that debilitated someone as powerful as Arion. Why hadn't anyone thought that was peculiar?
What do you mean, not all of it?
Her voice rose to an octave beyond what she felt a Koenig's tone should. Malcolm sighed.
You can see this field, can't you? Can you tell me where every snowflake has fallen? Or exactly how many there are? Do you know their relation to one another?
She stared at him incredulously. This wasn't what she wanted to hear. She wanted him to say it was all going to work out in the end. She didn't need to be told about snowflakes. Recent reports say the Frey have, she took a breath, dozens of dragons. Edgar's men have spotted them. They are also massing troops on our side of the Nidwalden. They won't wait for spring, Malcolm. She pointed at the Harwood. Every scout tells me they look to be preparing for a winter assault. Tomorrow, a Frey army could appear on the forest's eaves.
She pointed down the slope toward the trees.
Malcolm, we can't fight dozens of dragons.
She looked at the sleeping behemoth beside them.
Maybe one, possibly two if we're lucky, but not dozens. If we retreat, we can get out of their range.
By going beyond Alan Rist, our dragon can still protect us, and Lothian's dozens will be powerless.
The new Fane will have to make more.
If you leave, you will lose the war.
How? Explain that to me. How?
He thought a moment, then looked up at the stars.
It is extraordinary how so much is determined by timing. Being in one place rather than another at a singular moment alters the world. It happens all the time. Wraith and his father being at the Forks at the precise moment that Chagon, Merrill, and I passed is a perfect example. Didn't have to happen that way.
The mention of Wraith's name so close to the Galarabrin unsettled her. But the beast showed no sign of recognition, and it continued with what she suspected was a false nap.
So many events are connected to thousands of others. Another reason why it isn't possible to be absolutely certain of the future. There are focal points, however. Instances when so many paths converge that it would be foolhardy to ignore the pattern. Even the slightest alteration to these major crossroads cause the world to veer wildly. Oftentimes, it is necessary to stand quite still while a blow that looks like it will destroy you lands just a hairbreadth away. We are coming to one of those moments. The magnitude of this intersection is so great that I'm sure even you can feel it. That's why you tested me by coming up this hill tonight. You're nervous and worried.
Damn right I am. And I do feel it. Something terrible is about to happen.
Persephone frowned and clutched herself tightly.
I'm scared.
He nodded.
Just know this. We need to be here when she comes back, and so does Nephron. Right here.
He pointed at his feet.
We can't afford to flinch. Timing is everything.
Timing for what? And who do you mean by she?
He looked down.
Snowflakes, remember?
I think you're being vague because you don't want to answer me.
Well, you mentioned lying won't help, so here we are.
Persephone wanted to scream. He was just so infuriating. Knowing something, anything would help.
She put her hands on her head, came very near screaming, then spotted the dragon and thought better of an outburst. Instead, she made fists and shook them in tandem.
I just need a little reassurance, that's all.
That's good, because at this point a little is all I can offer.
Then do so!
He nodded. I saw a white wolf in a Stremnodon.
You saw what?
She stared, dumbfounded.
I don't understand.
As far as I can tell, Bryn is coming close to completing her mission. She doesn't know it yet, but she has very little time left. If everything transpires as I have seen it, and keep in mind it's very hard to guess at this point. The difference between success and failure will be determined by a matter of minutes, possibly seconds. If we are not here when Bryn returns, everything will fail, and more than you can possibly imagine will fall apart. Such a setback could unravel centuries of hard work.
Persephone stared at him. She wanted to believe, but all she had was the words of one man to cling to, weighed against the fate of the entire world.
What about the others?
Malcolm said nothing.
It's just Bryn, then. She's going into Stremnodon alone. She's going to save Suri by herself.
She's not there to save Suri. I didn't send her to save one person. I sent her to save everyone.
You keep saying her. But what about Moya, Tekchin, Roan, Gifford, Rain, and Tressa? And don't you dare mention snowflakes.
Persephone looked into his eyes and immediately stepped back. For a moment, for a brief instant, she saw more than she wanted.
The man before her, The simple, pleasant, awkward, ever-pleasing ex-slave was missing. In his place was a stranger. Within those eyes, she saw rage and hate on a scale so vast it caught her breath. And she saw sadness so profound that for a moment she forgot her own in his eyes. She'd glimpsed eternity stretching out like a road, so lonely it hurt her heart to think of the steps needed to walk it. "This place," he told her, "this hill and this time is a focal point, the center of a web. You've heard Suri and Arian speak of the art, how it's like a string game and all life is connected by threads. Well, they are right. The Miralef feel those connections. They sense them. But I can see them. They are endless, boundless, and more abundant than flakes of snow or grains of sand on all the beaches." Persephone continued to stare at the man before her. She must have started breathing again, but she didn't know when. She'd also started shaking. Maybe it was the cold. Malcolm didn't notice. He had turned away and was facing the camp. "Most of the time I can follow the paths, see the cross points. But this hill, this singular moment, is like tying a million threads to a single knot, all of them smaller than a human hair. Imagine them being all tangled and twisted. More than a million. More than a million, million, million. More than you can conceive of. That's what I see when I look at this hill tomorrow. It all leads to this one point. Everything runs through a tiny hole to this epic knot. I've been trying to untie it, but I can't. It's too hard. It has to be cut." He looked back at her, and as he did, she saw the old Malcolm, the apologetic man with the spear named Pointy. "Be thankful that Bryn made it through. Make sure we are still here tomorrow. And that Nephron is as well. That's all you need to think of just now."
"For the love of Elan, Malcolm, we're talking about Bryn. She's just a young, inexperienced woman. How is she going to... Oh, dear mother of all."
Persephone clasped her face in her curled hands.
"What have I done?"
"This isn't over yet."
"Did you know what would happen?"
She could see in his eyes that he hadn't. She could see he, too, was worried. And if Malcolm was worried, what did that mean?
"Oh, and one more thing," he said. "Either assign someone else to feed your fire, do it yourself, or let the eternal flame go out."
"What are you talking about? That's Habit's job."
"Not right now. I gave him a new one."
"My Habit," she said, bewildered. "You gave him a job to do?"
"A rather important one, too.
But I trust he is up to the challenge.
It will all make sense tomorrow. You'll see. The thing is, I hate to lose. I really hate to lose."
He left her then, and walked back down the hill.
Persephone looked out across the white-covered land at the forested horizon.
"Oh, Bryn, please be strong."
Chapter 17. We call him Malcolm.
That day, I discovered that animals can see and hear ghosts, but apparently mystics need proof. The Book of Bryn. The sound was clear and loud. It lacked any musical quality, sounding instead like a cry, a scream of hate and loathing. Imali and Volhoric stared open-mouthed. Wanderlei lowered the horn, refilled the air in his lungs, and said,
"It would seem you are wrong."
Then he held it out to Imali.
"Go on, take it."
Imali looked at the horn in his hands as if it were a poisonous snake.
Blow it, Wanderlei taunted. It's what you wanted to do, isn't it? Blow it, and tomorrow we can face off in the Carfrain.
And if you thought what my father did to Seferin was a spectacle, just imagine what I'll do to you after so many years of lies and deceit.
That was promised to me,
a small voice said, and Wanderlei turned to see the rune step into the ruins of the Erinthian. With her came a white wolf that Wanderlei remembered from a battle between Grindel and Arion in a rune village so many years ago.
How did it get here?
The wolf hung back near the door, where the guards had abandoned their post.
We had a deal.
The rune entered the circle of marble that was the central floor of the Erinthian.
I gave him the secret to making dragons, and in return, you are supposed to give me that horn.
She wasn't looking at him. Her eyes were on Imali.
Wanderlei laughed.
He was in a decidedly better mood than a moment ago. He sensed pain circling him and could still smell the scent of burnt hair. But he refused to look to his left, where Macaretta had been. All such things would be examined in time. But right now, he was riding the high of unexpected victory over unforeseen treachery.
Get in line, he said. Imali lies to everyone.
Is that true?
The rune asked.
Of course not, Imali said. But...
But what?
Wanderlei wasn't supposed to be able to blow it.
Why does that matter?
You told me and Margareta that he was to be fane,
Suri said.
No. He was never supposed to be fane. And yet, here we are.
Wanderlei grinned.
But Margareta...
The rune looked at the place Wanderlei couldn't. Shock and horror filled her face.
He wasn't supposed to be capable of sounding the horn, Imali went on. He should have been cast out and ineligible. I should have been the one, and Volhoric was going to blow it after me and immediately concede. I would have been fane, and...
She faced the rune.
I would have honored our agreement. I would have made peace with your people, I swear it.
The rune swallowed hard and pulled her sight away from the forbidden place. She focused on Imali.
After you became fane?
Yes, Imali said. It made the most sense. I could fix everything. I could stop the war, restore the balance between the tribes, and return Erivan to how it used to be.
The rune continued to stare at Imali, and the curator looked back as if pleading to be believed. Why Imali cared what the rune thought was beyond Wanderlei's ability to understand.
We trusted you,
the rune said. And once more she looked at the forbidden place.
She trusted you.
The rune took a step toward Wanderlei and held out her hand.
Give me the horn.
Of all the nerve.
Wanderlei was so stunned that he didn't do anything for a moment. He couldn't understand. And then he remembered the collar around her neck and smiled.
I see. You think because you have that collar on, I can't hurt you with the art. Or maybe you believe that your agreement with my father protects you.
Wanderlei pointed at the body on the floor.
Your safeguard went up in smoke. And as I learned when fighting at Alanrist, there are ways around the Arinfar.
With a small weave, Wanderlei lifted a huge stone bench and threw it at her. The size of it was so great that it wasn't merely going to kill her, but would likely crush Imali and Volhoric as well. This suited Wanderlei just fine. The curator and conservator both screamed and cringed as tons of marble came at them. The rune appeared unconcerned and clapped her hands as if applauding. The instant her palms met, the marble burst into dust, finishing its flight as a cloud. Wanderlei stared in shock.
How did...
He pointed at the collar.
You're wearing the Orinfar.
No, I'm not. It's just a collar. The rune reached up and touched the metal around her neck. She muttered a word of breaking.
The circlet cracked open, and she threw it on the ground. Wanderlei turned on Imali.
You did this!
The rune appeared to sigh, and Wanderlei sensed a bloom of power. Then she coughed, and he felt the horn ripped from him. It flew the distance between them, landing in the rune's hands.
Thanks, she said, and turned to leave.
You're not going anywhere with that, Wanderlei told her.
Watch me.
Wanderlei waved his hand, and the door Sori had entered slammed shut.
The rune sighed and looked at the wolf. Mina, you should stay out of this. You know that, right?
The wolf moved in a circle twice, then lay down on the steps. The rune looped the horn strap over her head and faced Wanderlei, but did nothing more.
She's waiting for me to make the first move. A tactical mistake. Grindel was a big proponent of first strike, last strike tactics.
Wanderlei went once more with fire. Suri watched Wanderlei with a puzzled curiosity as he attacked her with a blast of flame. The torrent grew around Suri's body like a cyclone of hot wind. Fire had been a poor choice, but she already knew Wanderlei was an idiot. Winter was a terrible time for everyone. Birds were forced to leave. Hardwoods, after being stripped naked, suffered ice and snow. Flowers were killed outright, something Suri had always thought of as unfair. A few months of sun and then, wham, frozen to death and promptly buried. Deer mice, hedgehogs, skunks and bats all just gave up and went to sleep for the whole season. No, winter was a rough time. Elan was asleep, and she didn't want to add to her burden. Suri felt the sleepy trees, the groggy thoughts far down the slope. She didn't want to take strength from them. Doing so would be rude. Wind was a better choice. It didn't mind being tapped, and in winter, wind was plentiful. With a flick, the fire he'd sent her way winked out. Just a momentary flash and a puff of smoke. Wanderlei hadn't expected that. His eyes went wide, then narrowed in anger. Suri had seen that look before. She'd seen it all previously. But the last time was in spring, and the irritated Frey Myrilith was Grindel, with his long, ugly fingernails, metal ring piercings, and cape of gold. Wanderlei had been there too. But he and Suri had stood and watched as Arion and Grindel fought. Now it was their turn.
Imagine that as you alter the patterns in that string, you are also altering the world around you. And because you are part of this world, you are also transforming yourself, Arion had instructed. If you can see this, then you'll know the truth. The string you weave is really yourself, and the pattern you make is your own life.
The string was life. The lines connected directly or through points to others.
This one just happened to be a straight line from that first fight between artists and Dalren and where she stood now. Her life had threaded between the two moments. One long loop tied and knotted. And this was that knot. And she had come around to it once more.
She selected her retaliatory strike, wind and ice. The weave was easy. Suri was surrounded by everything she needed. The breeze rose and swirled. With it came ice, forming sharp shards and foot-long icicles. She saw him struggling to counter as her attack grew larger and larger.
He will use fire to block because he's too flustered to think of anything else. It won't work.
A cyclone of deadly ice roared as it attacked. Wanderlei flinched as the icy tornado struck, then vanished the moment it hit him. The wind died, the ice fell, the roar ceased.
Wanderlei looked as puzzled as everyone else that he had survived.
"Protection of Feral," Volhorek said. "He's blown the horn and cannot be hurt by anyone except a challenger."
Suri thought that problem was solved easily enough. She took hold of the old ram's horn and blew on the little end. But no sound came out. Not even an ugly note like the one Wanderlei had made. Suri looked at the horn, puzzled, then tried again.
"Only one of Frey blood can sound that horn," the priest said.
Wanderlei's confusion was replaced by a great grin, and he attacked once more. Suri was baffled. His stance, fingers, and the words he muttered were all wrong. He was trying to be quiet, attempting to hide his attack, but he was clumsy and inept.
"He's actually casting fire again. Doesn't he know anything else?"
This time she snuffed out the weave before it even got going, leaving only a telltale puff of black smoke between them. His face was a mask of frustration. Arion had done something similar to him in Dol Ren, cutting him off before he even finished. And he hadn't liked it then, either. It had to be embarrassing. To know your opponent was so much faster and better than you that it was impossible to get a swing started.
How humiliating it must be to find a rune better in the ways of the art.
The two stared at each other, neither certain what to do next.
"Give Imali the horn,"
Volhorek said to Suri.
"Why?"
Imali glared at him.
"You can blow it and challenge Wanderlei.
And you can go to Nephril and rot,"
Imali told him.
"You are forgetting that a champion can be named to fight in place of the challenger. There's no restriction. It doesn't have to be a fray."
"This rune knows the art and can fight for you. If she wins, you'll be fain."
Imali's eyes shifted left, then right, before looking at Suri.
"Would you do that?"
"Tempting," Suri thought.
She'd long wished for Wanderlei's death for killing Arion, and she was frustrated by the protection that blowing the horn was providing him. But then she once more spied Macaretta's body. One part here, another over there, and realized she couldn't believe anything either Frey told her. For all she knew, giving Imali the horn might grant the curator the same safeguard that Wanderlei possessed. It could even be a trick that would cut her off from the art, the way the Orinfar had.
"No," she replied. "Frey lie as frequently as Belgric Lungrians."
"If you don't act as her champion," Volhorek said, "Wanderlei will rule. He'll have a fleet of dragons at his command and will kill all your people."
"If you support me now," Imali told her, "I'll fulfill my promise and work to make peace between our peoples. That was always my plan."
"She's lying," Wanderlei said. "Imali won't stop the war any more than I will. She's only telling you what you want to hear. You can't trust her."
Wanderlei gathered power. He was doing it subtly, muttering softly, trying to catch her off guard. Suri had no idea what he planned this time, but it didn't matter. With a word, she cancelled his weave before he even raised his hands. He let out a grunt of anger and stamped his foot.
"Look," Volhorek said, "I know you're suspicious of Imali, and with good reason. But it's Wanderlei or her. One person has blown the horn. If another Frey doesn't do so before this time tomorrow, then Wanderlei is fain by default. And he'll rule for the next 3,000 years. The Miralith will continue to dominate the Frey people, and every last rune will be hunted to extinction. You know that as well as I do. With him, you know what you're getting. With Imali, you at least have a chance for peace."
Imali softened her gaze and added a little smile, a motherly expression.
"Suri, you were a prisoner. And I freed you. You lived with me. I took care of you. Don't you owe me this?"
"No,
I don't. Suri shook her head.
But I got you out. I took the collar off.
To be kind? Why did you wait so long to do this? How many Gilarabrins did Lothian make? And what would have happened to Macaretta if your plan had worked?
Suri looked again at the torn body of her friend, then narrowed her stare at the old curator, who didn't dare reply. The four of them stood facing one another across the stained marble.
Suri, Imali said, after no one spoke up. This time she did so without the pleading or the false motherly tone. You're right. I didn't tell you the whole truth, and you can't trust me. But that doesn't change the fact that it is still him or me. No one else will challenge because only a Miralith can hope to win. And there are none within 3 days of here. You have to choose. Who do you want to be Fane?
Suri remembered Arion saying, Suri, you can be the difference. You can change the future. It's up to you. And in that moment, everything made sense. The future was hers to decide. The problem was, she didn't like her options. No one moved or spoke for a long time. Suri shifted her gaze from Mondalay to Imali with occasional short trips to the still smouldering body of the Fane and the remains of Macaretta. She also took notice of Lothian's larger bodyguard, whose name she didn't know, and Sain, who had gone unnoticed as she was almost totally buried beneath a fallen column. Imali's plan had led to this. She didn't care what happened to the people she manipulated. Would her rule bring further disasters? On the other hand, Mondalay had killed Arion, and Suri had learned firsthand what sort of person he was during her time in a cage on her travels to Estramnadon. As she stood and thought, Suri began to wonder if there might be a third option. She could wait until a day had passed, hold out until Mondalay became Fane, and then kill him. The problem with that idea was that she wasn't certain if the whole protection of Feral thing would still remain in effect. She considered asking, but doubted she could trust their answers. That was the problem. She couldn't rely on any of them. As Suri struggled to find a solution, an annoying sound pestered her, a nearby scratching noise. Suri looked at each of them. Imali wasn't moving. Neither was Volhoric or Mwandulay. The sound came from right in front of Suri. Looking down, she noticed small scratches appearing on the marble floor. Suri took a step closer. Imali looked at her.
What are you doing?
Suri shook her head.
Nothing.
Imali faced Mwandulay, who was also watching the scratches as they appeared in front of Suri.
Is it you?
Mwandulay shook his head.
It's not the art, Suri declared. Well, someone has to be doing it, Imali exclaimed, growing more agitated as she stared at the ground.
Suri looked at Mina.
First, I broke my toe, then it rained, then... Big events have an attractive, cumulative quality.
Suri reflected on this and quickly modified her statement.
Maybe it's more like an intersection, a crossroads where things meet.
This could be the moment Arion foresaw, an event so important that it could be seen from a distance.
Mina is here. I'm here.
Mondalay is as well, and now there is a scratching without a source. Nothing is accidental. Nothing. Suri crouched down to study the scratches. They were making a series of pictures. The first was the unmistakable shape of the horn that Suri held. The second appeared to be that of a spear. The butt end started at the horn, and the tip was aimed at the last image. It began as a rectangle, taller than wide. As more scratches were added, Suri could see it was a drawing of a door, and not just any entryway. Suri understood the message,
but had no idea who was giving it to her or why.
Who are you?
Suri called out. More scratches appeared, forming in a new place to the side of the old images. Everyone watched the progress as they appeared. This time, it drew the unmistakable image of an eye. Then another spear was drawn with the point going up away from the eye. The scratches stopped. And after a few minutes, Suri said,
Is that all? I don't understand.
That's when Mina yipped. The wolf trotted to Suri's side and looked up.
You know what this is all about, don't you? That's why you're here.
The wolf yipped again.
I hope someone knows what's going on, Volhorik said.
Out with it, Mina. What does this drawing mean?
In answer, the wolf looked up again.
That's not an answer, Suri said.
The wolf came over and sniffed the markings, then looked up. Suri continued to watch, puzzled. Finally, Mina threw her head back and howled. The sound echoed loudly under the dome. The noise startled Imali, who flinched. Volhorik took a step backward. Wanderlei raised his hands, but a glance from Suri stopped him.
Mina continued her wail. Howling had always been something the two did for fun.
Both would throw back their heads and harmonize. This hardly seemed the time or place for forest songs. But little had made sense so far, and the only one in that room Suri trusted was Mina.
If Suri's sister felt the need to sing, who was she to argue with the world's wisest wolf?
Suri threw her head back and that's when she saw it. High above them was the ceiling of the Arinthian. The underside of the dome was painted to look like the sky with two people looking down from intertwined wooden chairs. One was a rather homely female Frey, but the other...
Who is that up there? Suri asked.
My great-grandmother, Glyndora Thane, Imali answered. She was the first ruler of our people.
Not her, the other one.
Oh, that's Caratacus. He was her closest advisor.
Suri looked up again.
We call him Malcolm.
Suri was still looking up when she felt a tug on the horn. No one had moved, and at first she thought it might have been Mina. But the wolf had gone toward the door. Being held by the strap Suri had looped over her head and under one arm, the horn wasn't being taken from her, but it was most definitely moving. Suri didn't sense any use of the art. Mina gave another yip from where she waited, looking out at the night. Then Suri felt more movement from the horn. A light pull, a gentle tugging in the direction Mina wanted to go.
Yip!
Mina scratched at the door. Suri glanced back at the scratches.
I think I know what to do, she told the others.
Then, with a flick of one finger, the door opened. She glanced at the prince, but this time Wanderlei made no effort to stop her. Mina rushed out.
If you take the horn, Imali said, Wanderlei will be fain.
When it came to choosing who to listen to, Imali or a recently resurrected Mina, the decision was easy. Suri had no idea how any of it was possible. She didn't know why her dead sister had returned and appeared in a Stramnodon of all places, but she also had no idea how fish breathed or birds flew. Mysteries didn't bother her. Seeing Malcolm's face was answer enough, and without another word, she chased after Mina. No one made an attempt to stop them. The crowd of Frey that had gathered at the entrance and down the stairs pushed and shoved to give the pair room to pass. Mina led the way, trotting down to the plaza and then straight for the garden. As Suri ran to keep up, she noticed a flicker of light, a faint twinkling that appeared to follow closely behind Mina. Suri heard yelling. The noise didn't come from behind her. It didn't originate from the Arinthian. Such a disturbance would have been expected. Suri assumed that once she abandoned Imali and Volhorik, Wanderlei would exact his revenge.
He would do something to make them shriek in pain. But no such commotion rose. Instead, the yelling came from in front of her. As she approached the garden, Suri discovered another crowd. This one was only a dozen or so Frey, but their shouts were drawing more.
"The door!" someone cried. "The door has been opened!"
Those who had gathered stared in wonder, but no one ventured near. Suri noticed wolf tracks in the snow, the ones she followed, and an identical set going in the opposite direction.
"So this is where you came from, Mina? Is this how you got here?"
The crowd of Frey, in their flapping winter cloaks, backed up as Suri and Mina approached. The wolf trotted past them without a glance, and Suri followed her lead. Once more, she noticed a flicker of light, but now it was more of a shimmer. Approaching the garden door, Suri noticed it stood open about 2 feet, a little hump of snow pushed up by it. A larger set of tracks led in, but without pause, Mina entered. What was good for Mina was fine with Suri, so she followed. Once inside, the shimmering light took on a more defined form, and Suri realized that what she had been seeing was the ghostly figure of a woman. Behind the door was a sizable room. At its center was a grand but deceased tree. In the darkened interior, the shimmer was more readily seen. A young woman draped in a wren-patterned Brecon moor who watched Suri with eager eyes.
"Bryn," Suri said, "you can see me."
Bryn's voice was strange, distorted, as if she spoke from the opposite end of a long, hollow log.
"Can you hear me too?"
Suri nodded.
"But, what, how?"
Suri couldn't figure out a way to frame the question. There was too much to ask and too few words.
"I'm dead," Bryn replied,
and then quickly added, "at the moment, at least. Hopefully it's only temporary. I must look like a ghost to you. I can't see it myself, but I suspect to you I'm all glowy and see-through. Is that right?" Suri nodded again.
"You can see me now because we're near an entrance to Pyre, where the barrier between the worlds is thin. They blend a little.
Normally you can't. At least, you couldn't when Mina and I first found you up at those steps.
I can't believe I was reduced to drawing pictures with the key. Hope I didn't damage it.
You really should have learned how to read, you know." Bryn frowned and waved her hands in frustration.
"Never mind all that. It doesn't matter. I'll explain later. The real point is that we came to save you.
But," again, frustration washed her face,
"you didn't need saving. And as it turned out, your salvation wasn't the goal after all. Malcolm sent me to get that horn."
Suri had no idea how someone could be temporarily dead. All she knew was that this was indeed Bryn. And that left her wondering if she ought to feel sad or not.
"I know this doesn't make sense. I know it all sounds crazy, but it's true. I need to take that horn back with me to the dragon camp so Nefren can blow it. He'll be the one to make the challenge."
"It won't work," Suri frowned. "It has to be blown by tomorrow."
"I know," Bryn nodded. "I heard. But I'm pretty sure I can make it in time. Distances are shorter in Pyre than in Alan, and I can get there through this pool. In the afterlife, I'm very fast. You really ought to see me. Since I'm traveling east to west, I might have some extra time. I'm not sure how much, but it could help.
Roan would probably know better. But she's lost in the abyss." Bryn threw her head back and clenched her fists in frustration.
"Oh, grandmother, I know I'm messing this up. I know none of what I'm saying makes any sense. But there is too much to explain, and I have so little time that I can't..."
Suri held out the horn.
"Here, take it. You sure?"
At the sound of those two words, Suri felt tears rise. Sometimes the art was magical in the way it wove its patterns. Some were powerful, some complex, but some were just plain beautiful.
Suri nodded.
Pretty sure.
As Bryn took the horn, Mina yipped. They weren't alone. Standing by the tree, within the tangle of its bony roots, stood a person.
You again,
Suri said, recognizing the fellow she'd met in the garden when visiting Arion's home.
I've waited a long, long time, he replied,
and she noted sadness in his voice, and that Mina had positioned herself between them. The man wiped his face. He had been crying.
Are you all right?
No, he said,
and ran a hand over the trunk of the dead tree.
He killed her. Maybe he didn't create this prison, but make no mistake, her death is on his hands.
The man sounded devastated, bereft.
We all loved her. I didn't think him capable of... She gave him immortality. She saved him.
He took a step towards the ghost of Bryn.
You know where he is,
don't you? I don't know who you are talking about,
nor do I know who you are.
I'm looking for my brother, he said with disgust. I'm Trilos, second child of Alan and Eton. First to die, first to be murdered, first victim of Turin. And I'll see him punished for his crimes.
Your brother has changed, Bryn said. He's trying to make up for his mistakes. He's working to fix the world.
This, he shouted and pointed at the tree, is how Turin fixes things.
Bryn moved a step back.
But Ilan herself told me so.
She's his mother. After I destroy him, she'll still love me, too. She'll say she's disappointed, but she'll still love me. She'll have hope that I, too, can change. But Turin won't. He can't. He is evil and must be destroyed. That's what the Golrok is for. The last battle of the First War will see the death of Turin, and I plan to bring it about.
But he's immortal. He cannot die.
Then there's no reason not to tell me where he is.
Trilos took another step forward.
I don't actually know. It's been many years since I've seen him.
Trilos stared at the ghost of Bryn for a moment.
Fine. It wouldn't matter if you told me. He can see the future and will know to disappear. But I'll take the key he gave you.
Trilos held out his hand. The moment he did, Bryn retreated back a step.
It doesn't belong to you, and it shouldn't belong to him. Give it to me.
Suri had no idea what they were talking about, but she didn't like the sound of Trilos' voice. More important, neither did Mina. The wolf hunched her shoulders, fur raised, a deep growl issuing through bared teeth as she slowly crept forward. This got Trilos' attention. He turned, stunned.
You, Gilarabrin, you would stop me?
Are you aware your name has become synonymous with beasts of destruction? Ironic, don't you think? More than anyone. How can you defend Turin?
Mina's growl only grew louder. Trilos gritted his teeth and raised a stick he held in his hand as the two faced off. Unsure what Trilos and Bryn were talking about, Suri was certain of one thing. If Trilos fought Mina, he was going to face her, too. Suri guessed he wouldn't be as easy to subdue as Mwandalay. He wasn't normal. Nothing about him made sense, but there was power within, hidden and restrained, like that of a seed. But there was no mistaking his ability. Suri reached out, searching for a source of her own, but in that place she found none. The tree was dead, the grass gone. A small trickle of strength seeped in through the still open door. The wind was calm, but people were still gathering outside.
Their source was weak, and to fight him, she would need more power.
There's another source, she realized then. There always has been.
She felt it rise within her, and she blew across old coals, watching them start to glow, the heat rising within her.
So what emerges after a butterfly is sealed in a chrysalis?
Sori smiled.
It only took being buried alive to discover the obvious.
Bryn, go, Sori ordered. Leave now!
The ghostly figure of her friend, who was clutching the horn to her chest, didn't hesitate. She retreated toward the muddy pool.
Sori straightened her back, hands up, palms out.
She wasn't certain what she would do. This, she felt, wasn't going to be a battle of artists. Trilos wasn't a Miralith. He was both something more and something less. Her first inclination was to weave a shield, a dome, perhaps.
But she didn't know what she would have to block.
She had to be ready for anything.
The truly odd aspect of this confrontation was that she was inside this arboreal tomb, a dark place that smelled of withering wood and rotting soil. And she was facing a menace beyond her comprehension.
Sori's understanding of the situation was limited to a spattering of comments and the inadequate hints gifted to her by the art, all of which amounted to a few charred chicken bones in the dirt as seen by moonlight. Sori, however, was good at reading signs, finding patterns, and foretelling the future from nothing more than cracks and smudges. At that moment, the omens were not good. If she was honest with herself, they were absolutely horrific. And yet, she wasn't frightened or even worried. If anything, she was happy. For years, part of her had been dead, but now she was back, and she was free of her responsibilities to Arion, Persephone, Imali, Malcolm, and the rest of the world. Sori felt like a girl again, who was on a grand adventure with her best friend at her side. Even though the challenge before her held unimaginable danger, Sori didn't care.
This is what life is supposed to be.
She readied herself for the battle.
A voice came from everywhere and nowhere. Not here, Trilos.
Sori had spent a lifetime listening for the voice of Ilan, to hear the faint, hidden messages that she gave. But never before had the mother of all been so clear, so loud. The parental voice boomed with motherly exasperation.
Have you no respect? You shall not desecrate this place. Try, and you will fight me too.
Trilos gritted his teeth. He shifted his gaze back and forth between Mina and the retreating Bryn. Then he turned and looked at the tree.
Hasn't he done enough damage, Mother? When will you see him for what he is?
Drawing himself up to his full height, he shouted after Bryn.
I want that key!
Bryn didn't stop. Entering the murky pool, her shimmer faded. Mina advanced, growling.
I won't fight you here, Trilos told Mina. You have the advantage in this place, but then you knew that, didn't you? Oh, wise one. Yet your wisdom fails you in this. Turin is evil, and you're aligning with the wrong side.
The next time we meet, you shouldn't try to stop me.
Mina appeared unimpressed as she stopped growling. Her hair settled, and with a swish of her tail, she turned her back on Trilos and trotted for the door. Sori followed.
I mean it, Galarabrin, Trilos shouted. Stay out of it!
Sori and her wolf returned to the world of snow and ice.
The garden was filled with Frey, who, upon seeing her, let out a collective gasp. They retreated like a flock of birds. Sori didn't recognize anyone, which wasn't strange given how few Frey she knew. But neither Mwandule nor Imali was there. She would have liked to spot Treo, to
to thank her for her kindness. She had been the only one in Estramnadon to treat Suri with compassion. If Bryn hadn't shown up, Suri might have volunteered to be Treya's challenger, except she suspected the unassuming Frey had no interest in being Fane. As she walked past those in the crowd, a few of the bravest ones asked, "What's in there? What did you see?" She didn't bother to answer. She wasn't comfortable with the press of the crowd, and she began moving clear. It was then that she heard a familiar voice. "Suri," Nairi called. Arion's mother was on her way to the door, wrapped in a white winter cloak. Her face was knotted in confusion, fear, and amazement, as if Suri had grown long ears and a snout. No, she probably would have been fine with that. Seeing her emerge from the door was something else altogether.
"I saw... you just came out of... but..."
Nairi sputtered, her eyes shifting between Suri and the door. The priestess caught sight of Mina, which only served to bewilder her further. Then she narrowed her eyes at Suri.
"Who are you?"
Suri thought for a moment, and a smile came to her lips as she replied, "I am who your daughter always wanted me to be. I am the hope for peace between our peoples. I am the butterfly. I am the new Senslor." Then she turned to the wolf. "Let's go home, Mina." Entering the pool was painless the second time. Third time, Bryn corrected herself. This was her third drowning, though technically only the first one was real. Drowning implied a death. Since she was already dead, this was nothing more than a transition between worlds, which was likely why it was easier. That, and the fact that she was more terrified to stay than to go. She hoped Suri and Mina would be all right, and guessed that they would be because she herself had the key that Trilos wanted. Once she was gone, she hoped he'd have no interest in Suri and Mina. For a moment, she thought he might follow her. But given the effort she knew he went through to escape Pyre, she assumed he wouldn't. Despite this, after returning to Allison, after crawling out of the pool into that wondrous paradise, fearful he might pursue her, she looked back. She spent precious seconds watching that surface, but it remained still. Bryn wondered if she could run as fast as she hoped. She hadn't really tested her newfound buoyancy since climbing out of the abyss, and she wasn't certain if leaving and then returning might have hampered her abilities. Crossing Allison would be her first test of speed. She took a tight grip on the horn and key, crouched, focused on the door to Nifril, and ran. She hardly saw the little stone house or the fruit trees. The few people she passed did not appear to move, as if frozen in time. A moment later, she was at the mirrored doorway. "Faster than I thought," Bryn recalled her previous fears of the Queen, of Drome, of the Broken Bridge, and she smiled. "If I can run this fast, imagine what I can jump."
"Bryn," Wraith called to her, "wait."
He and Arya were near the door. Both trotted toward her, grinning as if they knew what had happened, or perhaps they were just happy to see her.
"I did it," Bryn shouted. "I have the horn. I just need to get it back to Nifrin."
They both beamed at her.
"We never had a doubt,"
Arya said, her hands clasped before her.
"I want to thank you for telling me about Gifford,"
Arya said. The woman reached out and hugged her.
"I always knew my son would win that race.
But it's good to hear the news." She hesitated, then took a breath.
"Can you tell me something? Was my son happy? Did he live a good life?"
Bryn didn't know how to answer. She couldn't lie, not in that place, not to Arya. She endeavored to frame the answer as best she could.
"Near the end, he did. For the last few years, yes, I think he was happy."
"I still say you shouldn't underestimate him," Wraith told them both. "That man has more reserves than anyone I know. He may have fallen into the abyss, but he's good at falling." Bryn finished for him, as a new thought dawned.
and Roan can figure anything out.
Bryn fished the key out from under her armor, which had returned when she entered back into the underworld, and held it up to them.
I need this to get out, but I don't need to take it with me.
Bryn, Wraith started. No, listen. I believe the way back to Alan can be opened and held clear the same way Tressa held open the door to Nephril. If that's true, I can leave the key in Rel for the others to use if they get out.
Bryn frowned.
Only they'd need to be able to...
Wait! They can pass from Nephril to Rel without the key, right? I saw Gifford's hand pass back through the portal. He was almost dragged back. So it's possible for them to return to Rel, right?
Yes, Arya nodded. As we told you, limitations here are what people place on themselves. And those who enter Nephril expect they can also enter Rel.
You can't leave that key in here, Wraith said. It's too dangerous.
It's also too dangerous for me to take out. Trilas knows I have it. If he finds me before I find Malcolm, that will be worse. In here, it will be safer, for now.
But Malcolm will want it back. You can't...
It won't stay here. I'll set a time limit. If the others don't claim it soon, I'll leave instructions that the key is to be delivered to Muriel. She's safe. She's immortal. She can't use the key, and she's Malcolm's daughter. If the others do escape, Gifford will certainly come here. He'll look for you, and you can tell him. But urge Gifford to hurry, because you're right. It won't be safe to leave it in Pyre for long.
Where will you leave it?
Arya asked.
I don't know yet, but I'll find somewhere safe, someplace they can all find it.
She gave them both hugs, then turned toward the mirror, where the face of a golden-armored hero looked back.
I have to go now. Good luck, and may Elan and Eton's blessings go with you, Arya said.
Give Persephone a kiss for me, Wraith said.
Tell her I understand why she made the choice she did, and I'm not angry. Let her know we can still be together, and I have the perfect place picked out. Tell her, if she still wants me, I'll be waiting for her.
Bryn nodded, then steeled herself and pushed into Nephril. As she did, she remembered Tesh's words once again.
Listen, can you promise one thing?
One thing.
If things go bad, you'll run. That you'll run as fast as you can and save yourself.
Run right back here. Don't wait for me. Will you promise that much?
Promise me that, Bryn. Promise me that much. Please.
Bryn was going to keep her vow. And so much more.
Chapter 18. Dropping Rocks.
When going forward doesn't get you where you need to be, going back will at least keep you moving.
The Book of Bryn. Using his wadded cloak as a pillow, Gifford lay on his side in the crook between the wall and the tooth-shaped rock. Doing so messed with his mind because he knew he didn't have a cloak, but he didn't have a head either. Between him and Tesh, Tressa was curled, head down, knees up, arms pulled tight like a newborn. Her eyes were closed, and she shivered and jerked as if enduring a nightmare. Of all of them, Tressa suffered the most in death. She'd never had it all that good in life, but in the abyss, she was the cripple. He reached out to her, wishing he could ease her suffering. That's when he realized that helplessness came in at least two forms. Those who couldn't do for themselves, and the people who could offer little more than a hand on a shoulder.
Maybe that's how Tressa felt about me when we sat on the porch of Hopeless House.
Being trapped in the abyss was a lot like his former home. He, Roan, Tressa, and Tesh were a set of lost misfits, ensnared by their own shortcomings.
But I escaped Hopeless House. How did I manage that?
He tried to think back, but everything was difficult at the bottom of Nephril, and getting harder.
Gifford had been lauded as a hero after his miraculous midnight ride through the Frey camp, but that hadn't been what saved him. Odds were good that he would eventually slip back into the familiar role of the cripple. People might still offer him a smile as they passed, but in their eyes would be that old, uncomfortable sadness. Eventually, they would forget his deed, and so would he. But when that happened, he'd still have Roan, and that was all he needed. On the mornings when he couldn't stand up on his own, when he wet the bed, or when he couldn't find a word without an R sound to express what he needed, she had been by his side. And during the nights when he doubted himself, when the memory of his heroic deed grew hazy, all he needed was to touch her. That she no longer recoiled was proof of his salvation and the reward for his heroic ride. Roan had saved him. Of that he had no doubt. Why can't I do the same for her? All of them were piled up like warmth-seeking puppies. Gifford reached for Roan, who had been cuddled against his back. He expected to feel her shoulder, but found nothing. Gifford sat up and looked around, expecting to see her elsewhere in the cave, but it was dim, desolate, and Roan was nowhere to be seen. He stared, confused, at the place where she'd been. How can she be gone? Gifford pushed to his feet and felt the weight, that strange heaviness that climbed onto his back, pulling him down. He knew that load, that drag of pointlessness and despair. He shouldered it now the same way he'd always endured life as a cripple. Hopelessness and the difficulty of standing and walking were as familiar as old shoes.
I'll be back. Just going to look for Roan, he told Tesh and Tressa, figuring they wouldn't be pleased about losing his light, even as dim as it had become. Still, being in total darkness would be worse, although neither bothered to respond. He wished he could offer words of hope before leaving, but he had none to give. Baffled as to why Roan would have left and where she would go, Gifford made a quick exploration of the cave, looping around the edges and stepping over the scattered tablets lying on the floor against the back wall. Where are you? Logically, he shouldn't worry. They were in the abyss, a vast wasteland of nothingness. Nothing down there could... Iva! The name flashed through his mind. Concern shifted to fear and then jumped to rage. Gifford's light grew brighter as he left their cave. He crossed the black expanse, his feet crunching the frost, as he searched among the craggy cliffs for the entrance to Ivar's lair. He had difficulty remembering which niche was the home of the carver.
How long has she been gone? Did Ivar walk right in and steal her? How could I not notice? Do I sleep that soundly? Does Roan? And why do we sleep at all?
Frustrated by an inability to remember the exact entrance to Ivar's cave, Gifford's anger grew. He flexed his fists and noticed that the sword, the one Roan had made for him in Alan Rist, hung at his side. His armor had disintegrated as he fell, but the sword was still there.
Has it always been?
He didn't think so, but he was glad to have it now.
Voices!